Your Secretary of State says everyone who's here, citizens and non-citizens, deserve due process. Do you agree, Mr. President?
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know.
Well, the Fifth Amendment says
I don't know. It seems it might say that.
No, it does say that, Mr. President. It does say that. Due process. Read it.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
It's the Constitution.
I got the feeling that something right.
You remember, you swore to protect
I'm
and defend it.
In case I fall off my chair.
Yeah, that Constitution.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Elsewhere in California on KFOI in Red Bluff and Redding and KKRN in Round Mountain. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York, WLPP, up in Rochester, New York on WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, Delmarva FM, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me. From bradblog.com, now in our 22nd year of troublemaking and muckraking. Thank you very much for joining us today on the broadcast. Okay, we are still in our fun drive here at LA's, my flagship station in Los Angeles, KPFK. So I don't know that we're going to have enough time to get to the phones to listeners today, but I hope you will consider calling in anyway in our live Southern California listening area or anywhere around the world to 818-985-5735. Hit button number 2. That'll send you into our fun drive room to make a donation of any amount you can afford to help the broadcast and KPFK and Pacifica Radio stay on your public airwaves at this particularly perilous moment, especially, by the way, since the phone system here at the station crashed last week in the middle of our show. I'm sure it was Desi Doyen's fault somehow.
It probably was.
Was it yours?
Gosh, that was a fun time.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
That was a fun time. But what it meant was it prevented anyone from being able to get through to make a donation during the broadcast. So we've got some ground to make up this week. I would really appreciate your help. Support our work. Because Donald Trump has begun his out-and-out attack on public media right now. So give us a call, 818-985-KPFK, or go to kpfk.org, where you can make a donation as well. Select some terrific thank you gifts there in the bargain. No matter how you do it, please do it, please. And when you do, please tell them that Brad from the broadcast sent you. All right, coming up in a bit, I will be joined by a guest who has been covering a police brutality case out here in Los Angeles. One which took a very unusual turn late last week and into the weekend when three career U.S. prosecutors in the U.S. Attorney's Office out here in Los Angeles resigned after Donald Trump's acting U.S. attorney here filed a motion with the court to enter a plea agreement with a former L.A. County sheriff who had already been convicted by a jury of a felony for using excessive force during the arrest of a black woman back in 2023. The legal affairs journalist who was the first to report on those unusual resignations, to say the least, joins us in a bit. But as ever, there's been a whole lot of news since we last spoke late last week. But I need to start with some more election news today, happily so. Last week, we reported on the stunning news out of Canada's election, where the Liberal Party up there, previously led by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, now led by Prime Minister Mark Carney, had been trailing Canada's Conservative Party, led by Trumpish Pierre Poilievre, by some 25 points in polling as of late last year, before Trump's hectoring of our longtime friends to the north, threats to make them the 51st state, huge new tariffs against them. Well, that all served to turn Canadians against Poilievre, whose party not only lost big time in the elections last Monday, but Poilievre, who had been all but measuring the drapes in the prime minister's office late last year, he even lost his own seat in Canadian Parliament in those elections in what was a clear backlash against the Conservative Party, thanks directly, pretty much only, to the obnoxious threats of the U.S. president in the middle of that election. And now, before last week was even out, it appears to have happened again in almost the exact same way in the nation of another longtime U.S. friend. That would be Australia. Donald Trump on Sunday... That's the wrong story. All right. In any event, here's what happened. Donald Trump affected yet another election. This time it was in Australia. And once again, it was the obnoxious comments and the trade tariffs that seems to have done it. And I've lost my notes on this, so I can't tell you exactly what happened. But suffice to say, in another election where it looked like the Liberal Party, in this case the Labour Party, was going to lose the election just a few months ago, what do you know? By the time we got to the election late last week, things changed, and the Conservative Party leader lost that election by a landslide, and the winner of the election, Albanese, actually, he's the prime minister now. It's the first time in, I think, 21 years that the party in charge did not lose their seat in the next election. So Albanese, everyone thought he was done, he was finished. Turns out, not finished at all. He is going to stay. For the first time in 21 years, the Trump tariffs, first 25% on Australia's aluminum and steel, then 10% across the board, had driven voters toward the even-keeled Albanese and away from his conservative opponent, Peter Dutton, whose plans and rhetoric had echoed the American president. Quote, Trump has absolutely dominated the trajectory of this election, said Sean Kelly, a political columnist for the Sydney Morning Herald, adding that the global uncertainty unleashed by Trump had made, quote, Albanese's boringness quite an appealing commodity. Well, I can imagine that.
Yeah, Donald Trump is really doing wonders for democracies around the world.
For democracies around the world, if not ours. Boy, would I love to have someone boring again here in office. With votes still being tallied, Labour appeared on track to increase its majority in the lower chamber of parliament from 78 seats to 87. The party needed just 76 to hold on to the governing majority. But in a shock that appeared to underscore Trump's impact, Dutton himself lost his seat, becoming the first opposition leader ever in Australian history to lose their seat during an election. As Trump's tariffs shook Australia's faith in the U.S. and fears of recession, nicknames like Doji Dutton and Timu Trump began to bite against Dutton, apparently. Dutton's a former police officer. He had waged a Trump-like culture war against diversity programs and so-called wake school programming, even promising an Australian version of the U.S. Doge service. I kind of want to tell our friends in Australia, yeah, you probably don't want to do that because it's a scam. It's not working here. It won't work there. But it looks like the Australians figured it out without me. In the final weeks of the campaign, Albanese came back from a deficit where he had been down 5 or 6 points just a few months ago. And by the election, eve of the election, he was so confident he was actually campaigning in Dutton's own district. And yes, it worked. Not only did his party win, but Dutton lost his own seat in Parliament. Meanwhile, back here at home, Donald Trump seems determined to undermine the electoral fortunes of his own party in upcoming elections over the weekend, doubling down on his unpopular tariffs and trade wars by threatening to add tariffs to American movies, which film in other parts of the world. An issue of note, I suspect, to many, particularly in our live Southern California listening area today. But Donald Trump on Sunday, perhaps to distract from so many of his other failed and or unpopular policies, announced on his Truth Social platform a 100% tariff on all movies, quote, produced in foreign lands, saying the U.S. film industry was dying a, quote, very fast death. Who knew? All due to the incentives that other countries were offering to draw American filmmakers. In fact, about a quarter of U.S. film and TV production has moved overseas in recent years, thanks to lower labor costs and special incentives that are offered by some of those countries. But facing a, quote, very fast death, I don't believe anyone other than Trump sees it that way. It's as if he's, I don't know, prone to exaggeration or something, that guy.
You think?
Maybe. In his post, he claimed to have authorized the Commerce Department and the U.S. Trade Rep to immediately begin instituting such a tariff, even if nobody is really sure how such a tariff on movies would actually even work. Will you be charged more at the box office for movies that are shot elsewhere? Would this new tax on movies apply to streaming content somehow as well? Does Donald Trump even have any clue about any of that? Quote, this is a concerted effort by other nations, Trump declared in his weird social media post, and therefore, he said, a national security threat. A national security threat? Movies made elsewhere?
Those sweet foreign films, they're a national security threat?
Apparently so. It is, he claimed, in addition to everything else, messaging and propaganda, and then in all quotes, we want movies made in America again, he added. Now, his post, as usual, was much longer, and even trying to report it and explain it, as we just did, makes it seem less insane than it actually is, if you read the whole tweet or whatever he calls it over at his failing social media site. But the Commerce Secretary and Trump lackey Howard Lutnick immediately responded on X, formerly Twitter, to say, quote, we're on it. Neither of them, however, provided any details about how this would be implemented. Meanwhile, politicians in Australia and New Zealand, where a lot of American films are now shot, at least in part, they said on Monday they would advocate for their respective film industries. After the president's announcement, Australia's Home Affairs Minister said he had spoken to the head of the government body Screen Australia about the proposed tariffs. He said in a statement, nobody should be under any doubt that we will be standing up unequivocally for the rights of the Australian screen industry. New Zealand's prime minister said something similar, adding we'll have to see what the details are of this that actually emerge. Of course, all of this comes amid Trump's trade war most aggressively with China, which is the world's second largest film market after the U.S., although in recent years, domestic offerings there have done better than Hollywood imports, in fact. A former senior Commerce Department official, William Reinsch, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, said retaliation against Trump's foreign movies tariffs would be devastating. That's right. devastating. All China needs to do, or anybody else in the world, say, these movies are not available. We are not going to allow American movies into our country anymore. And it will cost Hollywood billions, along with the U.S. economy. Said Reince, quote, the retaliation will kill our industry. He said, we have a lot more to lose than to gain, he noted, adding that it would be difficult to make a national security or national emergency case for movies. But of course, Trump has to do that. He has to declare them some sort of a national security threat because his authority to levy tariffs unilaterally handed to him by Congress, which now seems terrified to take that power away despite the devastation that it is causing to the U.S. economy and the world economy, that authority is predicated on there being some sort of national security emergency that the president declares and then is allowed to react to unilaterally by levying these tariffs like this. Despite the fact that I know California might love to see more production move back here, and Governor Newsom has, in fact, proposed new incentives to do exactly that. Trump's claims that movies filmed in nations other than the U.S. is somehow a threat to national security. Well, that seems pretty ridiculous, even by Trump's existing standards for ridiculousness. But, of course, he also spent the weekend declaring that he was going to reopen Alcatraz, the federal prison that was shut down decades ago due to the cost of running it after having long fallen into disrepair. But we'll get to that idiocy on another day, if we must, because of far more of note than any of that for the short term, Donald Trump's defiance of the rule of law itself, the Constitution itself, and even the legal profession itself. Trump, as AP described it, was circumspect about his duties to uphold the process rights laid out in the U.S. Constitution, saying in a new interview with NBC News over the weekend that he does not know whether U.S. citizens and non-citizens alike deserve the guarantee of constitutional due process. The comments came in a wide-ranging interview with Kristen Welker of Meet the Press. They came as Trump's efforts to quickly enact his agenda face sharp headwinds with Americans as his second administration crossed the 100-day mark with very, very low approval ratings, not just for him, but for every issue that he is on, including the economy, including immigrant rights. But in doing all of this, he has been chipping away at constitutional rights when it comes to immigration and due process in the U.S. Critics cite the case, of course, of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, the Salvadoran man who was living in Maryland. He was mistakenly deported by the Trump administration to El Salvador. He was imprisoned without communication. Trump now says Abrego Garcia is part of a violent transnational gang, but there has been somewhat anywhere between little and zero evidence to support that, even as the Republican president has sought to turn deportation into a test case for his campaign against illegal immigration, despite a court order saying that the administration must work to facilitate the return of Abrego Garcia to the U.S. Asked in the interview whether U.S. citizens and non-citizens both deserve due process as laid out in the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, well, Trump was noncommittal about that, couldn't say one way or another. I don't know. He said, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know, when he was pressed by Walker.
Your Secretary of State says everyone who's here, citizens and non-citizens, deserve due process. Do you agree, Mr. President?
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know.
Well, the Fifth Amendment says,
I don't know.
Much.
It might say that.
It does say that. It does say that, Mr. President. That's exactly what it says. Due process of law. The Fifth Amendment provides that, meaning a person has rights, certain rights, when it comes to being prosecuted for a crime, like the right to challenge that crime in a court of law as even the corrupted Trump-packed U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly indicated in the case of Abrego Garcia and others sent to that gulag in El Salvador under claims that they are gang members who are invading the U.S. under the orders of the government of Venezuela, claims none of which have actually been tested in court by the rule of law, by the rule of the Constitution, by the rule of the Fifth Amendment. So you had Secretary of State Marco Rubio out there over the past several weeks and others in the administration claiming that, well, everybody gets a due process, except if you're an illegal immigrant, in which case we get to send you away. Now, there are certain legal reasons that they may be able to make that claim, but the fact is you can't know if they are a so-called illegal alien, as they like to call them, until that has been tested in court, until that so-called illegal immigrant, that undocumented migrant, has actually had his or her due process rights in a court of law where the case can be made both for and against them. And it's not just the Fifth Amendment. Also, the 14th Amendment says no state can, quote, deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Trump said that he was pushing to deport, quote, some of the worst, most dangerous people on earth, but that courts keep getting in his way. Of course, how do we know they were the worst, most dangerous people on earth? He or his administration says so, but neither a judge nor jury has. And if they are so terrible, why wouldn't he be willing to put them before a court of law to let them make their case for or against it? Trump says, I was elected to get them the hell out of here, and the courts are holding me from doing it. Actually, sir, it's not the courts. It's the Constitution, which you swore on January 20th, just of this year, once again, to protect and defend. That is what is holding you from doing it. And thank God it is. And as if it wasn't clear enough that Trump actually reviles the Constitution and the rule of law itself, at least where he can't bend it to his political will, a federal judge late last week became the first to say that his attempts via executive order to punish law firms that he does not like for vigorously defending the Constitution that he does not like and the rule of law that he does not like and the rights of those people that he might oppose, that, those executive orders are themselves unconstitutional. Federal judge on Friday struck down in its entirety Trump's executive order aimed at the law firm Perkins Coie, saying his actions were an unconstitutional effort to punish the firm for taking on clients and cases that he dislikes. In the case of Perkins Coie, apparently, it was having Hillary Clinton as a client back in 2016. That was enough to deny Perkins Coie all of their rights and, of course, the rights of all of their clients as well. The ruling marked the first time a judge has permanently blocked one of Trump's orders targeting a law firm. Quote, no American president has ever before issued executive orders like the one at issue in this lawsuit targeting a prominent law firm with adverse actions, wrote U.S. District Judge Beryl Howell in a scathing 102-page opinion. The case, she said, quote, presents an unprecedented attack on the importance of independent lawyers. Trump has issued several executive orders punishing several prominent law firms with ties to his perceived opponents. He directed that those firms lose government contracts and their employees must be blocked from entering government buildings. You know, like courthouses. The president of the United States is issuing executive orders saying that lawyers from some of the nation's largest and, I would add, most respected law firms may not enter government buildings, may not enter federal courthouses due to decree by one man, Donald Trump. They also may not interact with government officials, you know, like prosecutors, like judges. and they may not be hired for government jobs, all by the decree of one man named Donald Trump. Perkins Coie was the first of four law firms that were targeted by Trump to file lawsuits challenging his actions. Judges have at least temporarily dropped most of those punishments for the time being, but they are all seeking to have his orders entirely struck down, as has now happened, at least at the district court level, in the Perkins Coie case. Nine other powerful law firms seeking to avoid Trump's wrath pathetically reached agreements with the Trump administration. These firms, which include some of the wealthiest in the country, pledged a combined nearly $1 billion in pro bono work for causes that the administration said it supports. That would be things that Trump supports. Nine law firms have done that already to try and stay in business. Well, guess what? If I ever need a lawyer, I ain't going to one of those nine law firms who I know are going to roll over for Donald Trump. So how long those nine powerful law firms stay in business, much less powerful, well, that remains to be seen after they have made an historic mistake, in my opinion, in cutting an agreement with Donald Trump. Trump, meanwhile, has boasted about the firms who have cut deals with them, even though those deals can be withdrawn at any time by Donald Trump. Perkins Coie and the other firms challenging Trump's court orders, those include Wilmer Hale, Jenner and Block, Sussman Godfrey. They have received an outpouring of support from the legal community, if not from those nine firms, although a lot of people have left those firms because of this. But hundreds of other firms have now and attorneys have now signed on backing Perkins Coie's efforts. In their case, Trump had accused the firm of, quote, dishonest and dangerous activity. And who knows dishonest and dangerous activity better than Donald Trump, frankly, and pointed to its representation of the campaign of Hillary Clinton, who was his opponent in 2016's presidential election. So, of course, that law firm needs to die. In her opinion, released on Friday evening, Judge Howell laced into Trump's orders, saying, quote, this action draws from a playbook as old as Shakespeare, who penned the phrase, the first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. Judge Howell said Trump targeted the firm because it had represented clients that he disliked or people who had challenged some of his actions, among other reasons. Quote, that is unconstitutional retaliation, she wrote, and viewpoint discrimination, plain and simple. That, of course, makes it unconstitutional. There was an important footnote where Howell was critical of those law firms who did strike deals with Trump rather than risk being targeted by one of his executive orders. She wrote, quote, some clients may harbor reservations about the implications of such deals for the vigorous and zealous representation to which they are entitled from ethically responsible counsel, since at least the publicized deal terms appear only to forestall rather than eliminate the threat of being targeted in one of Trump's executive orders. She said only when lawyers make the choice to challenge rather than back down when confronted with government action raising non-trivial constitutional issues can a case be brought to court for judicial review of the legal merits, as was done in this case, she noted. If the founding history of this country is any guide, those who stood up in court to vindicate constitutional rights and by doing so served to promote the rule of law will be the models lauded when this period of American history is written. Well, this period of history, American history, unfortunately, is nowhere near written yet, but some of the heroes are standing up and making themselves heard. And while Donald Trump is trying to legalistically, anyway, kill all the lawyers that he doesn't like, he's also busy getting cops off the hook for their own violations of law, such as pepper spraying innocent defendants, roughing them up, and threatening to punch them in the face, in fact. Three DOJ attorneys over the weekend resigned from the U.S. Department of Justice out here in Los Angeles as Trump's own lawyers, the actual corrupt ones, went to bat for a law enforcement official,
already found guilty by a jury before the judge had time to sentence him. Legal affairs correspondent Megan Cunniff joins us next to discuss all of that and what it means to Trump's so-called rule of law, in fact, his battle against the rule of law, at least as I see it. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast. Don't touch that dial.
Hi, this is Desi Doyen from the Green News Report and The Bradcast. What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
I'm a fool to do your dirty work. Oh, yeah. I don't want to do your dirty work no more.
No more. Still more Department of Justice prosecutors have quit now rather than do Trump's dirty work over the weekend. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. As the LA Times reported over the weekend, three career U.S. prosecutors based out here in Southern California resigned from the Justice Department over a highly unusual post-verdict plea agreement that was struck by the Trump-appointed acting U.S. attorney in Los Angeles. The plea agreement with a cop comes in a case where that sheriff's deputy, was convicted back in February this year of using excessive force during an arrest of a black woman last year. A federal grand jury indicted former L.A. County Sheriff's Deputy Trevor Kirk in September of 2024, 13 months after he responded to a robbery call at a grocery store out in Lancaster, about 70 miles north of Los Angeles, back in June of 2023, when he saw 58-year-old J.C. Houston and 56-year-old Damon Barnes, who matched the description of the reported robbers. Well, things went south quickly. Kirk and L.A. County Sheriff's Department Deputy Philippe Alejandre Jr. detained the man, Barnes, without incident. But prosecutors said that Kirk, sheriff's deputy, was, quote, unjustifiably violent with the woman, Houston, who was filming Barnes's arrest and told the deputies that they were already on YouTube Live. Good for her. Well, the cop, Kirk, ended up slamming Houston to the ground, putting his knee in her back before he threatened to punch her, then pepper sprayed her in the face twice. Here's a little bit of what some of that sounded like from police body cam video.
No, you can't touch me. You can't touch me.
Get down on the ground. Get on the ground.
It's already on YouTube.
Stop.
Live.
I don't get. Stop.
Stop
and get punched in the face.
You punch me and you're gonna get sued too. You already got sued. I got it on camera.
Stop. Turn around.
I got it on camera. Get off my. I can't breathe.
Hey, we're in a fight at the window.
I can't breathe. There's no fight. You took me down to the ground. Stop manhandling me. I didn't do nothing. You threw me down.
Well, that cop did get sued, and he also got charged with crimes. Independent legal affairs correspondent Megan Cunniff first reported on Friday that a plea agreement filed late Thursday last week says that if Kirk, the now former L.A. County Sheriff's Deputy, pleads guilty to misdemeanor deprivation of rights under color of law, the U.S. Attorney's Office will, quote, move to strike the jury's finding that, yes, he injured his victim, which made his crime a felony. In response to that proposed agreement on Friday, again, all of this after a jury has already rendered its verdict against this sheriff's deputy. In response to the DOJ making that agreement, the four federal prosecutors who had handled the case previously but did not sign this plea agreement between the DOJ and the cop, well, they withdrew from the case entirely. The plea agreement was signed on behalf of Donald Trump's acting U.S. attorney out here in the Central District of California, a man by the name of Bill Assayle, if I'm saying that right. It was signed on his behalf by an assistant U.S. attorney who was not previously involved in the case. And then on Saturday, the Times reported that three of those U.S. prosecutors, assistant U.S. attorneys Eli Alcaraz, Brian Fairstein, and section chief Cassie Palmer, had all resigned from the Justice Department entirely. Apparently, in response to all of this, the proposed plea deal, as submitted on behalf of Trump's acting U.S. attorney, which still must be approved by the judge in the case, sets up a dramatic downward departure in sentencing from what Kirk had faced with the jury's felony conviction last year. As CUNIF reports, Kirk faced about 9 years in prison under U.S. Sentencing Commission guidelines for his felony conviction, but his misdemeanor conviction, well, that carries a maximum of 1 year, and Trump's U.S. attorney, Bill Assayle, and the assistant U.S. attorney, Robert Keenan, agreed to recommend to the court just 1 year of probation. They also will not bar him from working again in law enforcement. As noted, a judge has still got to approve this plea agreement, but this sounds anything like Trump's vows to restore law and order to America, unless, of course, you count letting cops off the hook for injuring people unlawfully while they are arresting them who committed no crimes other than filming them arrest someone else. Unless you consider that to be the restoration of law and order in Trump's America. Joining us now is L.A.-based independent legal affairs reporter Megan Cuniff, who has been all over this story since initially breaking the story late last week about this plea agreement. Megan Cuniff, welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Really appreciate you joining us today. First off, I want to make sure that, did I get the key details of this story right? Did I misreport anything of note? Is there, something that I'm missing in the basics of our story up to this point?
Basics are correct. I would say that the reasons for the resignations, I mean, it's such a personal reason to resign, and mm-hmm. they're definitely pissed about this case, obviously, but they refused to sign the plea agreement. All four prosecutors who are assigned to the case refused to sign the plea agreement, but the resignations are multifaceted. And the idea that they resigned just because of one case, mm-hmm. I mean, this definitely was like kind of the final straw, but there's so much going on at the office that I think to attribute it just to one case is kind of, if this had happened under the previous U.S. attorney and mm-hmm. it was the only thing that had happened, it's kind of a weird hypothetical because he would have never done this.
Right.
But I don't think they would have resigned. There's just so much going on in the office right now. And I think the resignations they're just a little different because there was another prosecutor on this case who refused to sign the plea agreement too. Mm-hmm. He hasn't technically resigned. And does that mean that he's not sufficiently outraged about this? It's just there's all these things going on in people's lives that we have to worry about.
Well, maybe so, but I should note, Megan, did other prosecutors resign this week? I mean, all three of these had worked. The ones who resigned worked on this case.
There's been mass resignation. Uh-huh. They all still work there. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are going through the 4 month fork in the road program. I mean, no one just abruptly quit. Mm-hmm. They're like going through a resignation process right now. And mm-hmm. There's a lot of people quitting the U.S. attorney's office right now. And another thing, I don't think this is actually Trump's doing or D.C.'s doing. This is Bill, the new interim U.S. attorney, because when you look at the case, he was actually convicted on February 6th. So he was convicted under the Trump administration.
Right.
And the DOJ in D.C. has been lobbied about this by his supporters for a long time. It's just that Bill, the interim U.S. attorney, has a personal relationship, a political relationship, and knows a lot about this case. He's actually has a political relationship with the head of a police association that's really been supporting mm-hmm. this case. And from what I've heard, like DC doesn't even really care about this case. Well, this is Bill coming in and this is his personal pet project case here, which is one reason the prosecutors are so upset. But there's a lot of resignations going on. I've heard the chief of the criminal unit is leaving, and see all of them a lot of them took these promotions in January. under Trump, and it's Bill, it's the new interim who's coming in that's making them all want to leave.
Fair enough, but how unusual is it? Because it kind of reminds me of, you know, what we saw with the Justice Department during Donald Trump's first term, after Bill Barr took over, you know, after guys like National Security Advisor Michael Flynn had already pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI, after Roger Stone's trial, but before they could be sentenced, that the DOJ came in and said, hey, you know what, we're going to make a deal, or we're going to drop the case. That seems to be what happened here. How unusual is that, that the prosecutors will go all the way to court, get a, you know, go to trial, get a jury verdict, and then just a few weeks later say, yeah, you know what, we're going to rethink this and lower the charges that this guy was already convicted of. How unusual is that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've never seen it before. Definitely not. Like, it's totally unheard of. And you might see it if there's an issue of misconduct during the trial, or somebody's right, cooperating afterward, you might see something like that, but that's definitely not the case. And so, I mean, the prosecutors are definitely outraged after this, down to the fact that just a few weeks ago, they were defending this verdict in court against a motion to vacate it, and everybody was signing off on the documents and everything. But then, you know, 2 weeks later, Bill took over, and suddenly they're arranging this plea deal. So yeah, no, it's totally unheard of. That's for sure.
And just to be clear, the woman in this case, who ended up being roughed up and pepper sprayed and so forth, who threatened a lawsuit, she and the man here, Damon Barnes, actually did sue the sheriff's office. Apparently that is settling. It was a lawsuit, I think, for $3 million. Was that woman who we hear in that audio tape I played, was she found in any way, or the man, found to be involved in that reported robbery that brought the cops to the Winco grocery store in the first place?
You know, when I read the court documents, I didn't have the benefit of going to the trial, but the prosecutors have described the cake that the man was holding as lawfully bought. But he was arrested, and the prosecutor's focus, and they even say this in the court documents, is that they think the deputy's actions with the man when they arrested him were lawful. So I'm just, in my own reporting, I haven't dug into what exactly happened there, because I think the focus on the trial was really just the officer's actions, which are everything we see in the video. But I just, that stood out to me, because I mean I thought it was kind of a funny line to describe a cake as lawfully bought, but it's totally relevant, because it kind of disputes the idea that there actually was a shoplifting incident, but something happened, because the prosecutors found it acceptable the way they handcuffed and detained the man. But I'd have to look more into their lawsuit, which recently settled for $3 million. They need approval from the Board of Supervisors. So I'm wondering if this plea deal could hinder that at all. What's going to happen?
Interesting. You also note in your report that the judge in the case, the U.S. District Judge Stephen Wilson, who is a Ronald Reagan appointee from 1985, he will still have to approve this agreement. Would you expect him to do so? And how much discretion does a judge have in a case like this, where the prosecutors themselves are essentially dropping the central charges against the defendant that he has already been found guilty of?
A lot of attorneys who have experience with Judge Wilson don't think he's going to go for this at all. Somebody said to me, oh, he ain't got time for this. But I think what'll happen is he has to accept a guilty plea. If Kirk wants to plead guilty to something, he'll take that. But then it says in the plea agreement that he can still sentence him in accordance with the jury's verdict. So that will be up to him, and a lot of people think he will, but without the benefit of the prosecutors advocating for that, you're not going to have a sentencing memorandum that really explains, here's why you should do it, here are our calculations for this sentence, and here's what the sentence should be. So it'll kind of just be up to the judge. And I mean, I could see him sentencing for the felony, but not doing the 9 years, doing less than that, but the public isn't going to have the benefit of that kind of advocacy.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's up to 9 years. Of course, he doesn't have to get the full 9 years, even under the misdemeanor.
About 9 years. I heard it was like 102 months. Those are always, the U.S. sentencing guidelines are always.
The sentencing guidelines, right. But I mean, he doesn't have to necessarily be sentenced to all 9 years. That's just the guidelines. And even in the guidelines for a misdemeanor, it's up to a year, but it can be zero. So, but what you're suggesting is he could still sentence him under certain guidelines. Am I understanding that correctly? Of the felony itself, even though they're pleading down to a misdemeanor in this agreement.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, because the misdemeanor carries only up to a year, but he could definitely do more than that and say, I'm going to recognize the jury's verdict and still keep this as a felony. So that'll be the big question. I mean, what's he going to do? A lot of people think that that's what he'll do.
Well, and he sort of gave an indication not long ago, last month, I guess, he with the judge here rejected the prosecutor wanted 3 months so they could work things out, work out this agreement. The judge says, no, we're not meeting for sentencing until, what was it, May 16 or something like that. You guys have plenty of time to work this out. I'm not granting you the 3 months.
Yes. Yeah. They wanted 3 months to just, and they even said, just review the case. And the judge said, it seems like you have plenty of time to review the case here. So I remember the victim's lawyer was making the point when this plea deal came out that, you know, he thought he needed 3 months to review the case. And then he comes around within weeks and has this plea agreement. It kind of made you wonder whether he really reviewed the case.
Exactly. That's what occurred to me. And by the way, this is not the only case that Bill Asaley, is that how we say his name? This U.S. attorney, he's the acting U.S. attorney, although he has been, I think, nominated by Donald Trump to be the permanent U.S. attorney for the Central District of California, which includes L.A. It's also the most populous U.S. attorney district office in the country. So Asaley is now reviewing other cases as well since he's been tapped for this job. What do we know about him, and do we know what other cases that he is now reviewing, and if they also are seemingly focused on, I'm sorry, I got to say it, Megan, but it's seemingly, you know, letting cops off the hook here.
Yeah, he's definitely a Trump loyalist. He's been there since, you know, 2016. Earlier than that, he resigned from the legislature, California State Legislature, to take this position. He is a former federal prosecutor who worked in the Riverside office, has some experience prosecuting cases from years ago, but I've asked, what other cases is he reviewing here? I haven't been able to get any kind of answers, but one I know for sure is pretty concerning. It's a case of national security that actually the former FBI informant who was convicted of lying about the Bidens in what prosecutors described as a Russian-influenced campaign. It got a lot of attention, and it was prosecuted by the same special counsel's office under David Wise that investigated Hunter Biden. They came about this case as they were investigating Hunter, but of course, as soon as Trump took over, those guys were gone, and now all of a sudden they're trying to get this guy who took a plea deal and was sentenced back in January.
Yeah.
They're trying to get him out of prison pending appeal, saying that they're going to support his appeal. And they actually went to the trial court the other week and asked the trial court judge who presided all over this and said, all of a sudden, we want to support his bail pending appeal.
Right.
And the trial judge wouldn't do it, but they're going to go to the Ninth Circuit. And what was interesting was the prosecutor, the assistant U.S. attorney who argued for this, is the same one who went to court to argue for Trevor Kirk.
The cop.
Kirk's sentencing delay.
Right.
The
cop who is apparently getting let off the hook here if the U.S. Attorney's Office in L.A. has anything to say about it. And you're referring to that was Alexander Smirnoff. He's the former FBI informant who apparently is in jail, pleaded guilty to lying to federal officials, lying to the FBI. Basically, he's the one who came up with the story about related to Joe Biden's daughter's diary or something like that. He ended up pleading guilty to tax crimes and lying. That's the guy who these people are now trying to spring from jail?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, why am I not surprised about that for some reason? You report that he has announced other objectives as of being named to the U.S. Attorney's role out here. But he didn't say that he would be reviewing cases like this. So this does kind of come out of nowhere. So when you say it's not coming from D.C., do we really know that, Megan?
Well, I think the Smirnoff case is definitely coming from D.C.
Okay.
I mean, I think Bill is fine with that and definitely supports that for sure. But I do know that the Trevor Kirk case is more of a pet project. But I think there's definitely other cases that he must be reviewing either from his own interest or from D.C. directives. I just I right now don't know others other than the Smirnoff and in the Kirk case, but there is, and one I suspect he's reviewing is the prosecution of this former CEO of Fatburger, who the AUSA was fired on that through basically like a directive from Laura Loomer. Mm-hmm. But I think that case has some DC attention.
Now, all of this, last thought here, sounds to me at least very much like what we've been hearing over the past several months since Trump took office, whether this is coming from DC or not. But we've heard about longtime career prosecutors, you know, offering their principled resignations. You know, in the act of being asked to do something that they know to be inappropriate or against the law or the Constitution. We saw that, for example, in the case recently of New York Mayor Eric Adams, where a whole bunch of longtime top senior prosecutors at the Southern District of New York and at Main Justice all resigned rather than, you know, sign on to dropping the criminal corruption charges against Mayor Adams. It kind of feels like we're looking at the very same thing, even though I guess they haven't yet given a statement about why the these attorneys out here in L.A. were resigning. We're just sort of speculating around all of this, or have they given statements to the media yet?
No, they haven't given statements just because, I mean, the atmosphere out here is just a little bit. It's just a little bit different. It's less high profile. You don't have like the widespread viral support. And, you know, like I said, it's different. It's not like there's just one. I mean, this was a big driver of it, but there's so many different reasons to resign. I mean, it's not like this is the only case he's doing things on. It's just they all have their different reasons for resigning. And the case is a big thing, but it's been kind of oversimplified for the reasons for their resignation. And I'm not sure they see any benefit in talking. And another thing is, it's not like they just abruptly quit. And, you know, these are people with lives and families, and there's health insurance, and there's just stuff that they all need to think about.
But they did abruptly quit, didn't they?
Well, I mean, they were working on this case. Resignation, but like right now, these people are still, and they withdrew from the case. That's the key. They abruptly withdrew from the case. Every prosecutor and every person that you would expect to have their name on their that document refused to put their name on it. Three people, and since then, in the last few days, have submitted their resignation. And it was definitely driven by this case, but to say that it's just because of that case is incorrect.
Okay, fair enough.
Because of a bunch of other stuff, too. But it is, I mean, it is an outrage, and they're outraged about that case. But so are the people who didn't resign specifically because of that case.
Well, right, and it is an outrage, but it really does have those echoes of cases that we have seen, and we've never seen it, to my knowledge, in you know, administrations other than those that have Donald Trump in charge, where you've got these prosecutors who are working for sometimes years on these cases, get a conviction, and then all of a sudden the DOJ wants to say, you know, do an Emily Latella here, basically. Oh, never mind. And the people who worked on the case say, we want to have nothing to do with this anymore.
Yeah. And I think the actions here are almost worse than Eric Adams. And I don't want to downplay the Eric Adams case at all. But, you know, he hadn't even been convicted yet.
Right.
Here's a jury verdict that they're just like, let's throw this out and forget about it. I mean, it's scary.
It is scary. It is scary. And it's remarkable. I'm really glad you covered it and you gave it some light. I know you're glad I didn't call you today to talk about Diddy's trial. This is more important. Thank you. You're welcome. And thanks for staying on top of cases like this. As you say, they do not get the same kind of attention that similar cases out east are getting. So great to have an LA-based independent legal affairs reporter out here on this beat. Megan Cuniff is the author of the newsletter you can read called Legal and subscribe for it, legalaffairsandtrials.com. You can also follow her on Twitter at Megan Cuniff, though it's difficult to spell. I will have it all for you at bradblog.com tonight. Megan, I hope you'll think about getting over at Blue Sky. We could use you over there as well.
Oh, I'm there on Blue Sky. Find me on there.
Oh, you are? I tried to.
I am. Yes.
Same name.
An H and two N's in Megan.
I will stalk you down and find you there, whether you like it or not. Megan, really appreciate your time today. Hope to talk to you soon. Stay in touch.
Thank you so much.
You bet. All right.
Wow.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, and it's not getting the same kind of coverage, of course, that Mayor Adams got, you know, when he was sprung. But it's a very similar story, it seems to me.
Yes.
And I don't know if it's because it's out west. It's not getting the same kind of attention that a story like this might have gotten in D.C. or New York City.
You know, and there's so much that's going on. It's not surprising, you know, with this tsunami of all of these changes coming through, especially with the big changes at the Department of Justice and how that is trickling down to the U.S. attorneys in the different states and the different districts, like here in Los Angeles. Yep. I did want to point out that, you know, that Megan had mentioned that the case of Alexander Smirnoff, that they were working to try to get him out of jail after his guilty plea for lying to the FBI.
Yes.
So what he was responsible for was he was the one during the 2020 presidential election who said that officials at the Ukrainian natural gas company Burisma had told him that they had offered Hunter Biden a seat on their board. That was all nonsense, completely fabricated. But, you know, we got a whole bunch of nonsense that came out of that in investigations from Republicans.
A whole bunch of nonsense and lies that we heard for years on this show that we had to, I don't want to use the word defend, but we had to respond to and say, no, these claims, there is absolutely no actual evidence of it. Oh, well, they got a whistleblower. They got an FBI informant. This is the FBI informant. He's in jail for having lied about all of these things. And now the Trump administration, it seems, is trying to spring him.
Exactly.
All right, we got to get out here. My thanks again to Megan Cuniff of LegalAffairsAndTrials.com. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my board operator today, Wendell Handy, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. You can also drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com and on the Facebooks, Mastodons, Twitters, and of course, Blue Sky, you will find me at the Brad Blog. All right, that's it. We got to go. We will see you at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate.